So we took a video showing where the road could go. We did a load of bird counts, filed all that to the court system. 2 days later, the judge ruled against the road widening project. So amazing. Wouldn't have happened in the US or in England, but it happened there.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert McFarlane, whose latest book is A River Alive. I'm Rich Walensky on Bookwaves. You can find extended versions of many of these interviews by going to the Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. You can write to Bookwaves at either bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Good morning and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO, Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning, we have Jeff Godsell on the recent release Weapons, Britta Gordon on the Criterion DVD of Working Girls, and Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time on another Criterion, Eastern Condors. And now here's Jeff from Essentials of Cinema with a look at the surprise hit Weapons.
For a while now, it's been pretty obvious that the horror genre is alive and well. Not only have there been plenty of horror movies released in the last couple of years, but when you see any movie in the theaters these days, trailers show you that there's more to come. Fortunately, among this plethora are some of the best movies as well. For every I Know What You Did Last Summer redux, there's a Nosferatu, a Sinners, what have you. Long Legs, Heretic, Bring Her Back, all worthwhile. And now, Weapons, which opened on Friday, August 8th.
This is a true story that happened in my town. So this one Wednesday is like a normal day for the whole school. But today was different. Every other class had all their kids. But Mrs. Gandhi's room was totally empty. And do you know why?
As the trailer and even the poster makes clear, the film's initial premise is this. Last night at 2:17 a.m., every child from Mrs. Gandhi's class woke up, got out of bed, went downstairs, opened the front door, walked into the dark, and they never came back. And that is exactly how the movie starts, clearly explained by a child in a voiceover. It's the why and the what are we going to do about it that takes up the next 2 hours. For starters, that setup is not entirely accurate. All the children from Mrs. Gandhi's class did disappear, that is, all but one. But that leaves plenty of angry, desperate parents who, at a meeting at the school, turn their wrath against Mrs. Gandhi herself, played by Julia Garner.
I don't understand at all. Why just her classroom? Why only hers?
Where are our children.
We have a lot of emotional parents here. I think it's best if you keep some distance from this place.
Surely she knows more than she's letting on. She must. And no one is more insistent on this point than Archer Graff, played by Josh Brolin, whose son is one of the missing. Archer even goes so far as to suggest that Justine Grady is the instigator. To start sorting all this out, writer-director Zach Cregger, in this his second feature after the well-received Barbarian of a few years ago, embarks on a Rashomon-like narrative, zoning in on each one of the participants, eventually including even some that we haven't yet been introduced to, with each section showing what they saw, what they experienced. Unlike Rashomon, where each person's version of the truth seems to contradict the other, proving that everyone is a liar, each person's section here shows things exactly as they occurred, only from different perspectives. And each section adds more than the last, clarifying some mysteries, but sometimes also adding more. And this is a marvelous technique and handled brilliantly by Cregger. It had me loving this movie well before the halfway point and before any of the main mysteries were even solved. And a strange thing happens as each of these narratives unfold. Each of the protagonists becomes less and less, well, heroic or even likable. Compromises in their intentions, cracks in their moral integrity all appear. It's a fascinating element. It doesn't really change our desire to solve the mystery of these missing kids, but it does alter our inclinations of how we think we're going to get there. There are all kinds of surprises, both large and little, to discover along the way in weapons. And even when it's over, you might think back and say, wait, was that important? But it's really a blast to watch these things unfold, and without giving up any spoilers, suffice to say that all the mysteries are solved, even if things do get wild and wacky. Weapons is a mystery horror film, and while the first half might be focused on the mystery aspect, the horror is coming. Trust me, the horror is coming. And it is sometimes graphic, and it's sometimes funny. Which brings up another aspect of the horror genre that is so hot right now. Extreme nature of the violence. Certainly there are filmmakers who reveled in pushing the ticket before, in going to excess as a stylistic choice. Brian De Palma and David Cronenberg come to mind. But lately it seems like there's a competition to see who can outdo the other. I feel like the unofficial starting gun for this race was shot by Tarantino in the ending for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And it's usually in the ending that the bloodbaths and the freakouts reach their fever pitches. The Substance, Smile 2, Cuckoo come to mind, and Weapons is no exception. But I can't remember a more satisfying or even funnier use of the de rigueur gore scene as it is used here. And suffice to say that a late appearing but essential character played by Amy Madigan is in strong contention for villain of the year. And as for the title, it's still a bit puzzling as to its meaning, although there are some allusions to the violence and the loss suffered by the victims of school shootings. Nevertheless, there are enough solid answers to the mysteries of the plot to compensate for any puzzlements or lapses in credibility, and to make Weapons the best entry in the horror genre, at least so far this decade. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. Next is Britta on Working Girls.
Watching the recently re-released film Working Girls, about a day in the life of an upscale Manhattan brothel, set off a series of thoughts that aren't entirely disconnected. About the way in which the current sophisticated state of television production really suits some thematic material, think the employees of a brothel and their clients. Perhaps even more than film. about how we take the idea that sex is idealized in a wide variety of films for granted, about the stubbornness of the world's oldest profession, which has fascinated male filmmakers for decades and should be equal fodder for female film directors. The film is directed by Lizzie Borden. I reviewed her first film, the scalding satire Born in Flames, a few months ago. It was released in 1986 and is now out from the Criterion Collection on Blu-ray, DVD, and streaming. Borden is starting to get a belated due with interviews in Vanity Fair and reviews in the New York Times. But unsurprisingly, these two films excepted, she hasn't had an easy time in a system that has limited her control of her own productions. Let's hope the increased attention might change that. Working Girls begins with Molly, played by Louise Smith, waking up next to her female partner. Molly is white, her partner is black. They exchange loving glances over breakfast with their teenage daughter. Molly goes into her dark room to do a bit of work, then gets on her bike, weaving through the neighborhood, stopping at a grocery store for flowers, and navigating her bike into a different apartment, which we begin to understand is a place of work, in which Molly is humorously ribbed by her colleague Gina, played by Marussia Zak, who holds her knees as she tries to insert her diaphragm. Side note, I had to look up whether these things still were used. Apparently, they're making a comeback. Molly is a strawberry blonde. That's important in this film. And it appears she has a degree from Yale. Gina, dark-haired with a quiet voice, lives with a boyfriend and yearns to do something else. Neither has told their partners about their working lives. The third in this trio is Dawn, Amanda Goodwin, who barges in late, throwing her bag on the couch, cursing at the fact that her boyfriend insisted on bringing her to work, resulting in the necessary subterfuge of entering a different building until he finally drove away. Dawn is all expressive emotion. Her hair is teased back in a distinctive 80s horsetail. She's wearing a short leather skirt, and the first thing she does is to beg Molly to write her an essay for one of her classes, on her knees. "It's on the peculiar nature of communist charisma," she wails. "No way," says Molly smoothly. "I'm already renting out my body. I don't want to sell my mind." Dawn is also, from the get-go, the most overtly critical of the so far absent boss, Lucy, but it's clear that employee dissatisfaction is fairly high at this establishment. These conversations, frank, funny, sad, are the lightening highlights of an increasingly monotonous day of one unremarkable yet demanding client after another. In a wonderful discussion over hamburgers regarding whether any of them would like to be the boss, or more bluntly, a pimp, Dawn remarks as she messily gulps down her lunch, "I've always been a whore." One of my reactions to this film was almost visceral, as for a while in the late 90s, I rented a room in an apartment that had very recently, in fact, been a brothel. My enormous built-in bed with lights running around the edges took up the entire room, just down the narrow hall from the closed-in fake marbled bathroom and up the stairs from the laundry area recently opened out from what had been a false escape closet. This world of working girls, like that apartment, has a timeless, closed-off, claustrophobic quality. There's no sense of the outside, of day or night, which makes each successive visit from a client that much more unbearable. How long can this day be? As recent reviews have pointed out, this film is a clear-eyed commentary on the transactional nature of this enterprise, as well as on the relations of labor with management. All of the women try to hide at least some part of their income from their sweet-toned and highly suspicious boss, Lucy, who is conducting a very questionable affair with one of the brothel's clients, herself. They complain of irregular hours. They are clearly made to work overtime. They are asked to offer services, such as what Lucy describes as, quote, light dominance, even though it is against policy. While Lucy, always impeccable in a cream silk suit and teased blonde hair, castigates her employees, telling them the place is a mess. It does get messy. The hamburger leavings aren't completely whisked away before the next client enters. That she only makes them do laundry once in a while. That they don't appreciate that she gives them a safe place. The tenuous nature of her generosity is all too apparent, particularly when a new and clearly nervous employee enters the brothel. Mary, the new hire, gets a tongue lashing for taking a phone call from her frightened child and is set up with a client, although she's clearly not prepared for the experience. Another new hire, who also starts on the spot, is bluntly told that she'll likely attract fewer clients due to her skin color, which in fact is the case if this one day is any indication. The film is unabashedly on the side of the girls, whose mournful, wry, angry complaints against their boss are balanced with a general good-heartedness when it comes to each other, especially in the face of clients who are shown in the many unglamorous ways that sexual proclivities, not dolled up with lighting, mood music, soft lenses, or our general sympathy for their romantic results, are expressed. Clients pose in front of mirrors, get spanked while their abuser raps out a rehearsed text, and force the women to play parts in their scripts involving doctors and virgins. This last is especially poignant given the recent revelations regarding U.S. gymnastic coach Larry Nassar. There's nothing sexy about it, cinematically speaking. But harder to watch, and more instructive, are the scenes in which the men themselves try to stray from this script. "It would be so different, wouldn't it, outside of here?" asks one of them of Molly. This small space allows them their fantasies, but the fantasy is really about taking this fantastical world with them. Of course, it's the one thing those working girls can't promise. Until Molly, after a day in which she's been told both that she's smarter than others and, quote, just a whore, having watched clients pick and choose her coworkers as if they were avocados, witnessed the possible abuse of a coworker who bleeds after a session, and spending all day in the confines of either a tiny living room offering men drinks while they wait, or in one of the lugubrious rooms upstairs, unfolding clean sheet on bed after bed for client after client, Molly ends up accepting the card of a client who tells her, basically, that he'd give her enough money to live for her services outside the brothel. And after one of several confrontations with her boss, Lucy, in one of them she asks, "Lucy, have you heard of surplus value?" Only to have Lucy reply, "Molly, don't be so patronizing. I went to a good school, too." After all that, she quits. So much for the get-ahead Yale gives you if you're a struggling photographer in this world. We're not going to know her final decision, but on the morning that she wakes up after that day, as she does in the opening scene of the movie, next to her partner, her eyes open suddenly, as if she realizes that whatever choice she's made is even more terrible. The film is shot TV style, with bright lights and medium close-ups, and makes you wish that Borden might try to do another version, this time a longer TV series in which the characters could be elaborated and the intricacies of the situation teased out, as it were. While you know nothing has essentially changed, the film feels a bit dated, and the characters a bit superficial. I also miss the rebellious, quasi-satirical, all-out headiness of Borden's first film, Born in Flames, in which women unapologetically stage terrorist attacks, castigate each other for not being radical enough, and commandeer society's infrastructure resources for their subversive activities. By contrast, this film is about a world in which subversion is unthinkable because its object, male desire, and the ability to acquire what is desired, is at the heart of women's economic daily lives. You can sneer at the guy who's being spanked, but that's about it. As Borden's film points out, none of the working realities of life in a brothel, with one, shall I say, enormous exception, are any different than the realities of any workplace, which is what makes it so amusing, so outrageous, and such a cynical film as well. There are lots of wonderful moments, and Borden gets assistance from some notable helpers. Nan Golden supplies the stills that Molly has shot and is developing in her darkroom. David Van Tiem, a percussionist, composer, and theatrical performer, is responsible for the terrific score, which utilizes bells, claps, drums, and other disconcerting sounds to give a sprightly ominousness to the proceedings. And one of documentary film's most famous cinematographers, Richard Leacock, has a cameo as a client named Joseph, a man Lucy playfully calls her financial advisor, and who tells the assembled girls, plus a client or two, that Lucy's fantasy is, quote, rolling around naked in a room full of money. "I can't help myself," says Lucy cheerfully. "I had a very materialistic upbringing. The two things I love most in life are sex and money. It's just that I didn't know until much later in life that they were connected." The scene goes on with Joseph, who is the light dominance client, telling Molly rapidly in his East Coast City Brahmin accent, "I'm in your power, I'm in your power." Indeed, the locus of power shifts around in this sinful cloister of an apartment an inch or two, but it's clear that for those working girls who, for whatever reason, have decided to enter this profession without a union, government regulation, or a human resources department, there are just two options, stay or go. In the last few years, Borden's been joined by some other notable digressors from the usual male gaze on the fascinations of prostitution, notably Sean Baker, who shines a mercilessly orange LA light on the world of trans prostitutes in the disconcertingly amusing Tangerine. But if you read the stories in the news media about this trade, you see how very little has changed. Currently, the New York State Legislature has bills under consideration to decriminalize prostitution, which has sex worker advocates and battered women's advocates, among many others, shoring up their barricades. And all presided over by the disgraced Governor Andrew Cuomo. A fitting irony for filmmakers who might see an opportunity. Perhaps someone like Lizzie Borden? She'd make the whole thing into something more than next year's Wikipedia article.
Thanks, Britta. And you are listening to Community Radio KBO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today, because as you know, the KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive is on, with an on-air goal of $450,000. On a side note, at KBOO Community Radio, we want to assure our listeners that despite losing federal public radio grants and the Corporation of Public Broadcasting preparing to shut down, we will continue to represent the voices of our community and not waver in these difficult times. KBOO is made by people like you, for people like you, and is accountable only to you. With the loss of $110,000 in federal funding, we are counting on supporters like you to help make up the loss and make KBOO stronger than ever. Go to kboo.fm/donate and support KBOO's mission today. Up next is Matthew's review of the recent Criterion release of Eastern Condors, directed and starring Sammo Hung.
Released in 1987, this action-adventure film is set in the immediate aftermath of the American withdrawal from the Vietnam War.
During the last 2 years of the war, we transported a large shipment of Sammo 26 bombs to a secret military arsenal in Vietnam. Before we pulled out, we tried to destroy that arsenal, but sadly, we failed. In other words, 2 million pounds of explosives could fall into the wrong hands. There's no way the U.S. can send troops or bombs in, but that arsenal has simply got to be destroyed, whatever the cost is. I've already chosen from among our troops 12 Chinese Americans for a SWAT force, and this file here contains your orders. But as far as the U.S. Defense Department is concerned, it simply does not exist. Only the name of your mission: Eastern Condors.
Now, besides this commando unit, they're also going to send in a group of convicts. So here the movie is a little bit like The Dirty Dozen.
All the information you requested on the Asian prisoners is here. All of them have had connections with Vietnam in the past. It's in the files. Anyway, you take your pick.
So the plan is to have this group of commandos go in, but we'll have this group of convicts, like the Dirty Dozen. They'll be paradropped in as well, and they'll kind of be as a diversion so that the real soldiers can get to the base and destroy it. So as the colonel explains this to Lieutenant Colonel Lam, here played by Qingying Lam, whom you may remember as the Taoist monk who fights the vampires, the hopping vampires, in the movie Mr. Vampire. But here he's this lieutenant colonel, and he's been put in charge of this Dirty Dozen group. At first, the CO tells the lieutenant colonel that, this is just a diversion. Make sure you don't get yourself killed with these guys. But then he confides in him that his brother is hiding out in the nearby village. He had been in the base, the American base, but had been sick when the evacuation took place, and he could not be moved, and so he's hiding there. And so the colonel mentions to Lieutenant Colonel Lam that he would like if he could rescue his brother as part of the mission and get him out of there. And so the movie kind of follows along where they're in the planes and they're flying over, and we get more introduction about the characters. The final twist comes in as the convicts, the Dirty Dozen group, they've all jumped off the plane, and Lieutenant Colonel Lam is about to jump. The radio operator comes out and says, the other plane's been blown up. The mission's canceled. The colonel's dead. And Lieutenant Colonel Lam says, well, they've all jumped. tell him I jump too, and he jumps in after them. And so here, of course, it's like he's responsible for these men, and so he continues with the mission. But also, he had promised the colonel that he would rescue his brother. So right off, we have these character conflicts which really motivate the plot and the story, besides all the action sequences and the fighting and everything. Well, now, once they're on the ground, the survivors, the Dirty Dozen group, they meet up with the Cambodian female guerrillas, and they're the ones who will lead them to where the base is. But of course, they make a diversion and they go to this village to get the brother and rescue him. Along the way, they meet the final character, who's kind of known as Rat, and this is played by Ewan Biao, and he's a sort of black market, swashbuckling kind of character. He rides around on this motorcycle, and he's got all sorts of balloons, and kids love him and everything, but he's a formidable fighter. And so he and Sammo kind of take over the group, and they take him to the base. You know, besides this sort of straightforward adventure story, what usually describing this movie, you'll come across the term rip-roaring. And that's because it's a very nice balance between the action sequences and the talking sequences. The talking sequences, you know, give us more about the characters and their backgrounds. And then their actions will lead to the next sequence. So everything's really nicely character motivated, even though the plot's all really kind of straightforward adventure plot. You know, there's something in the jungle that needs to be found, and there's other obstacles in the way, and the heroes need to make their way to this base and destroy it. And so along the way, we also get the conflicts within the different groups within the main group of heroes. We've got the women guerrilla fighters and what their situation is. We've got the different criminals. A couple of them are brothers. They're like two sets of brothers, and then we have older criminals. And they're starting to rethink whether they should have just stayed in prison instead of going on this dangerous mission like they've done. We have the lieutenant colonel who's trying to hold everybody together. And of course, we've got Sammo, who's trying to emerge as the hero. And then within the village, we've got the brother who's been hiding out, as well as this character Rat, played by Ewan Biao, who's attached himself to him, thinking that the man knows about some treasure, which is why he's pretending to be a crazy person. And so all of this like serves in to just keep the plot moving. Now, there are some amazing fight sequences that are in this movie. At one point, Sammo is able to use a palm leaf, use the stem of the palm leaf, and turn it into a deadly arrow. There's some amazing stuff that is done in this movie. Him and Ewan Biao, as you recall, both grew up in this Chinese opera school along with their classmate Jackie Chan. This movie was made a year before a movie I talked about a few months ago, Dragons Forever.
So it's shot in the Philippines, so there's lots of gear and tanks and explosions and stuff going on. Lots of great sets. And like I said, the script is really very good. I
would say that it's the sort of movie that Quentin Tarantino goes to bed at night dreaming that he could make. You know, missing are the grandstanding monologues and outrageous action. Even though the action is outrageous, it's carried out by the performers throughout this whole thing. So I'm talking about the movie Eastern Condors from 1987. It is now out on a very nice disc from Criterion. They have some extras with interviews with Sammo Hung and about the other movies that he'd made. There's a commentary track, but it's one of these situations where they kind of talk across the movie. It's more about what the movie scene in Hong Kong was like at this time, as opposed to what's really going on in the film. So it's a action war melodrama with which really considered a kind of all-star cast. I mean, for Hong Kong audiences, they would recognize many of the other convicts in the cast, and also the many villains that show up. I mean, of course, the villains get exactly what they've got coming to them, and the final fight within the base is really outstanding. And we've got a really dangerous character, this Vietnamese general, who turns out at first to be a kind of a silly character, but is a very formidable fighting. And so this is Eastern Condors, now out from Criterion.
Thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and